The movie Forgetting Sarah Marshall is the latest of quite a few comedies from the past year that include Judd Apatow's name somewhere in the credits. He wrote and directed Knocked Up.
He's treating my kids like they're dogs.
No, he's not.
Go get it. Fetch.
He's fetch. The
All
kids.
Right.
He wrote songs for the musical spoof Walk Hard.
Walk hard. Hard.
He produced Superbad and Drill Bit Taylor.
We need to learn how to take a punch. Let me go first.
In just 8 years, Judd Apatow has worked as a writer, director, producer, actor, or songwriter in more than 20 films and TV shows. Some reviewers suggest Apatow may be spreading himself too thin, but our critic Bob Mondello offers his take.
You kind of know what you're getting with Judd Apatow comedies, optimistic romps in which really ordinary guys get really lucky. Or as Jon Stewart put it on The Daily Show earlier this week.
Funny movies where beautiful women fall in love with underachieving, average-looking Jews.
That certainly fits 40-year-old virgin, Knocked Up, and now Forgetting Sarah Marshall. But Jon Stewart left a crucial ingredient out, the unapologetic vulgarity that makes Apatow's romantic comedies appeal to young men who see everybody else's romantic comedies as chick flicks. Scenes like the Knocked Up conversation about how pink eye relates to flatulence, or the chest waxing sequence in 40-year-old virgin. In Forgetting Sarah Marshall, there's full frontal humiliation for an unbuff Jason Segel. Countless mortifications were visited on Will Ferrell in Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. And Apatow juvenilia positively revels in the crude. Superbad, for instance.
Why the f*** would it be between that or Muhammad?
Muhammad is the most commonly used name on Earth. Read a book for once.
Fogel, have you ever actually met anyone named Muhammad?
Have you actually ever met anyone named McLevin?
No, that's why you picked a dumb name.
Ew.
Judd Apatow is hardly the first filmmaker to realize that gross-outs and movie grosses can go hand in hand, nor is he the first with the average guy gorgeous gal bit, which was, after all, a Woody Allen staple. Individually, his narrative devices aren't new, but in combination, they feel new. What he's done is formulate a repeatable, recognizably realistic blend of cuddly raunch. And then he's produced a lot of it. And because he uses a sort of Apatovian repertory company in which folks like Will Ferrell and Paul Rudd and Jonah Hill keep showing up in each other's films, movies that he directed or wrote or sometimes simply helped greenlight all blend together in the public mind. And that, I think, is where this notion comes in that the Apatow brand is overextended. A decade ago, Apatow had his fingers in just as many pies as he does now. The Larry Sanders Show, The Critic, both on TV, plus The Cable Guy and two other movies, all in 1 year. But nobody was saying Apatow, Apatow, Apatow back then. They were saying Larry Sanders and Jim Carrey. These days, Mr. Multitasker is doing the interviews and getting the attention. So when his projects slip a little, he gets the fallout.
You'd be surprised. Anything can be turned into a weapon of mayhem or destruction.
Even a puppy?
Especially a puppy.
Drillbit Taylor was sluggish at the box office. Has Apatow lost his touch? Well, he didn't write or direct it. He was one of its four producers, which is also true of Forgetting Sarah Marshall. So if those films feel less funny than Knocked Up, which was itself clumsier than The 40-Year-Old Virgin, should he get the blame? For reference, think back a generation or so to the Judd Apatow of the 1980s, John Hughes. Also a writer, director, producer, actor, and sometimes songwriter, Hughes, in a 3-year burst, directed The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Weird Science, and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and within a couple of years of that burst of activity, had written and or produced Uncle Buck, Mr. Mom, Pretty in Pink, Home Alone, two National Lampoon Vacation movies, and a dozen other comedies. Overexposed? Absolutely. And in his dotage, he's slowed down a little. That's a joke. He's still in his 50s. Eventually, Apatow will slow down too, but he's just turned 40, so it's not quite time yet to make Producer Man, The Legend of Judd Apatow. When somebody does, let one thing be noted. You know where the Apatovians got their story for Drillbit Taylor? John Hughes. In Hollywood, legends recognize legacies. I'm Bob Mondello.
Well, we're not going to forget Sarah Marshall just yet. To promote this movie, Universal Pictures is running a 5-city billboard campaign. There are messages scrawled in black across a white background, messages about Sarah Marshall. In the movie, she's the beautiful girlfriend who dumps Jason Segel, who devotes the rest of the movie to trying to forget her. Or at least that's what I'm told. The billboard messages include, "My mother always hated you, Sarah Marshall," and "You do look fat in those jeans, Sarah Marshall," and that's fat, spelt the old-fashioned way, with an F. So, what's it like being Sarah Marshall nowadays? Well, we decided to ask Sarah Marshall.
My name is Sarah Marshall. I'm a stage manager. I'm on tour with Disney's High School Musical. I'm in San Francisco. I live in New York City.
Well, New York City is one of the places where they have these billboards.
My boyfriend just told me that he was at work, and he looked out the window, and a taxi cab drove by, and it said, "I'm so over you, Sarah Marshall." And he said he thought he was hallucinating. And then another friend of mine called me from Los Angeles and said he almost drove the car off the road because he looked up and saw the billboard, and he called me right away, and he said, "What did you do now?"
That is Sarah Marshall of New York City, who's actually working in San Francisco this week, and she was talking with us about being Sarah Marshall. Joining us now from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, is Professor Sarah Marshall.
Yes, I teach at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. I teach printmaking and drawing.
And what's it like this year being unforgettably named Sarah Marshall?
Well, I own the domain name sarahmarshall.net and sarahmarshall.com. And so I've had a lot of traffic, over 20,000 hits at my personal website.
So instead, people who might be Googling this movie are going to see some very interesting prints?
Yeah, lots of different things. And I've been interested in creating a piece that involves getting a group of people all over the country who have the name Sarah Marshall. And the movie just has made that kind of an easy way to maybe get those people to contact me.
You could call the project U.S. Marshals.
Yes, exactly. Or perhaps even the Marshall Plan.
That is Professor Sarah Marshall of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and we turn now to Greenfield, Massachusetts, and Sarah Marshall. Hi.
Hi.
What do you do in Greenfield, Sarah?
What do I do? Well, I play pool and I hang out with my friends. It's just a quiet, nice town.
The billboards have all of these gross messages for Sarah Marshall. You're aware of this?
Oh, yes. And I do not look fat in those jeans. That's all I got to say.
Well, I gather you've actually taken out some revenge here.
Oh, yeah.
What have you done?
Well, I put up a poster that said, "You suck, Judd Apatow," in the same way as the "You suck, Sarah Marshall" posters are up.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give him a little taste of his own medicine.
Well, Sarah Marshall, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Marshall speaking to us from Greenfield, Massachusetts. We also heard from Sarah Marshall in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and Sarah Marshall of New York City.
Four years ago this month, some pictures became public that will be forever etched in our collective consciousness about the war in Iraq. They were the photos taken at the Abu Ghraib prison.
You remember them. A hooded prisoner standing on a box, wires attached to his hands, seemingly threatened with electrocution. And then a pyramid of naked Iraqi prisoners and a young female soldier smiling as she holds a leash around the neck of an inmate who is on all fours.
That soldier is also etched in our consciousness. Her name is Lindy England. She's one of several soldiers at the Iraqi prison featured in a new documentary by Errol Morris.
Here's the now 26-year-old Lindy England telling her story.
We didn't kill them. We didn't cut their heads off. We didn't shoot them. We didn't cut them and let them bleed to death. We just did what we were told to soften them up for interrogation. And we were told to do anything short of killing them.
It's shocking to see Lindy England speak in the movie. It makes you realize how little we've heard from her and about her until now. Errol Morris says that's why he made Standard Operating Procedure, to tell the story of the people who took the photographs.
These photographs have been so politicized. I don't know of a better way to describe it. They share one thing in common. They all assume that the people who took the photographs are monsters, and hence we have never really looked at them and tried to understand what they did. It's an attempt to move beyond politics, to find out something new about something that everybody has seen. And I tried to remedy this Also because I was curious about the photographs. What do the photographs really show? Why were they taken? What were these MPs doing?
And a lot of us think that they were doing something unspeakable. And so tell us the story of this particular photo to begin with, the one with her, Lindy England, holding what looks like a leash, and at the other end is a naked Iraqi prisoner. What happened before and what happened after this shot was taken?
Lindy England posed in the photograph because she was asked to by her boyfriend, Chuck Grainer. And in fact, the picture that we are all familiar with is a cropped photograph. There was another MP in it as well. It was cropped so that it became about this very, very tiny American girl and a naked male Iraqi prisoner. Another photograph, perhaps the iconic photograph of the Iraq War. It's the picture of the hooded man on the box with wires. It has become the picture of torture and abuse, familiar around the world. And yet in my movie, one of the investigators points out it is nothing more than standard operating procedure.
The individual with the wires tied to their hands and standing on a box, I see that as somebody that's being put into a stress position. I'm looking at it thinking they don't look like they're real electrical wires. Standard operating procedure. That's all it is.
This might have been a scene orchestrated so a picture could be taken. The wires were put on his fingers just prior to the picture being taken, and they were removed immediately afterwards.
Why? Why did they do that?
Perhaps because it looked shocking. And according to the military investigator himself, this was not a criminal act.
Now, you have him going through hundreds of photographs.
I do.
And a lot of them, interestingly, were multiple angles of the same event. So lots of people were taking photographs there, even though it was ostensibly not allowed?
Photographs were taken by many, many, many soldiers, and cameras were actually for sale at Abu Ghraib. There was a vendor there selling cameras.
That is extraordinary. I mean, so it indicates that the people there didn't think they had anything to cover up.
One of the extraordinary things about this story is I don't think this is all that there is to it, but I believe a certain part of it is they took the pictures because they were shocked themselves by what they saw and wanted to provide some kind of evidence to back up their claims later on.
Now, you're referring to Sabrina Harmon?
I am indeed.
She's the young woman who took many, many, many photos and wrote letters home to the woman she called her wife about what was happening there and exhibited a lot of confusion and fear and disgust over what was happening.
The letters are very, very powerful, unique in a way for me, because you can look at the pictures. The pictures, of course, are all from the fall of 2003. You can hear the retrospective accounts from the various soldiers. But these letters were written at the time the photographs were taken.
October 20th, 2003. I can't get it out of my head. I walk downstairs to find the taxi cab driver handcuffed backwards, naked with his underwear over his head and face. He looked like Jesus Christ. At first I had to laugh, so I went and grabbed the camera and took a picture. One of the guys took my asp and started poking at his dick. Okay, that's funny. Then it hit me. That's a form of molestation. I took more pictures now to record what's going on.
The way she describes it again and again and again is she knows that there is something seriously wrong, and she wants the pictures to prove it.
Do you see her as a whistleblower, as a hero here, or do you see her as someone who is also caught up in what was going on there and was conflicted?
Sabrina is not someone who can be described as a villain, but I don't believe she's someone who can be described as a hero. But let me give you one example. I would prefer that the audience thinks about it themselves rather than allow me to tell them what to think. There's one photograph. Sabrina Harmon is smiling with her thumb up over the corpse of a man named Al Jamadi. People saw the photograph and were appalled. I might add, myself included. Well, guess what? She had nothing whatsoever to do with this man's death. The top echelons of the chain of command were involved in trying to cover up the murder. Her commanding officer told her, "This is a heart attack victim." Without Sabrina Harmon's photographs, we would never know about this crime, a crime that she herself was in no way involved with. Under another set of circumstances, she would get a Pulitzer Prize in photography. And yet, this is how it went down. The people involved with the crime and the people involved with the cover-up have never, ever been punished. The only person threatened with punishment over Al Jamadi's death was Sabrina Harmon for taking a picture. And you have to ask yourself, what is the crime? Is the crime photography? Is the crime embarrassing the administration, embarrassing the military, embarrassing America? Or is the crime murder?
That's documentary filmmaker Errol Morris.
It was during some of the bloodiest days of World War II that a young Marine private from East Los Angeles did something that remains unmatched. He persuaded 800 Japanese soldiers to surrender in one day just by talking to them. For a while, he was known around the world as the Pied Piper of Saipan. A filmmaker is trying to make sure that Marine's act of heroism isn't forgotten, as NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
His name was Guy Gabaldon, and in the years after World War II, he was just another regular Joe, living in Southern California, driving a truck, and then one night in 1957, Gabaldon became famous.
This is your life. A program for all America. And now here he is.
Most of the people who had TV sets were watching that night, tuned into the little guy who did something really big.
Tonight, Guy Gabaldon of Gardena, California. This is your life.
Gabaldon's story was perfect for television because it seemed like a drama, only it was real. It happened on the island of Saipan in 1944. Gabaldon, a Mexican-American, single-handedly persuaded over 1,000 Japanese soldiers to surrender.
And never in the history of the United States military has one soldier captured so many of the enemy.
That's filmmaker and military historian Steve Rubin. He says Gabaldon's secret weapon was the fact that he spoke Japanese. He learned it as a kid growing up in East Los Angeles, surrounded by Japanese Americans, or Nisei. The TV show This Is Your Life served as their reunion. The first voice you'll hear is Gabaldon's boyhood friend, Lyle Nakano.
Guy with his Nisei friends would go up north, pick lettuce, and he learned to speak Japanese that way. I mean, talking to the fellows all the time.
Yes.
And I can say this, he certainly learned his lessons well.
Lyle Nakano's twin brother, Lane.
Guy was always trying to prove that he had a lot of guts, and he had them. But one thing, Guy always stood by his friend.
Gabaldon had a perforated eardrum and was rejected by the Army. The Marines didn't want him either until they learned that he spoke basic Japanese. And that's how he wound up on the island of Saipan as a military scout at the age of 18.
My ability to speak Japanese was very limited, but it wasn't difficult to say, tell, get the kokonikin aside, raise your hands and come on out.
A few years ago on NPR's Talk of the Nation, Gabaldon explained how he persuaded so many Japanese soldiers to surrender.
At night, I'd usually go to the caves. The Saipan is just full of caves, and I'd get to one side of the mouth of the cave, and I'd say, you are completely surrounded. I've got a bunch of Marines there with me behind the trees. If you don't surrender, I'll have to kill you. And usually it worked. Not always. I'd have to throw grenades in and kill. And I'd get maybe 10, 15, 20 at a time, and One day I got 800.
There had never been anything like it. 800 surrenders in one day. That's why Gabaldon's commanding officer, John Schwabe, dubbed him the Pied Piper of Saipan.
In asking him what he was saying to him, he would tell them that he would give them water and give them medical attention, and if they didn't come out, they'd probably get their ass shot off.
Hollywood eventually latched on to Gabaldon's story, and it turned into a movie called Hell to Eternity. The film featured incredibly realistic combat scenes, but it took lots of liberties with Gabaldon's personal story. For example, the 5'4" Marine was portrayed by the 6'1" actor Jeffrey Hunter.
You say that, maybe I try to talk him into giving up.
Gabaldon, are you out of your mind? You're really looking to get your head blown off.
The biggest glitch in the movie is the fact that Guy Gabaldon is basically portrayed as a Caucasian living with Japanese Americans.
Filmmaker Steve Rubin.
And that was completely inaccurate. His Hispanic heritage, his ethnicity, his whole background was completely obliterated and plays absolutely no reference in the story.
Rubin was just a young kid when he saw the movie, but the story stuck with him. He was intrigued by the American Marine who spoke Japanese. And then years later, through a series of coincidences, Rubin met the man himself.
The phone rang at my home about 8:30 at night, and lo and behold, it's Guy Gabaldon calling me. And he was very apologetic. He said, "I'm sorry to call you so late." And I said, "Guy, it's like hearing from Davy Crockett." And I was just blown away that I was on the telephone with one of my childhood heroes.
Gabaldon and Rubin became fast friends, and the filmmaker soon decided to make a documentary about Guy's life. Now the film is out. It's called East L.A. Marine, and Rubin uses it to ask a basic question. Why was Gabaldon passed over for the Medal of Honor, even after his commander recommended him for it?
Many people are recommended for Congressional Medals of Honor because of the number of enemy they kill. Guy, in a different way, saved thousands of Marines' lives by capturing an enemy that refused to be captured. And it's true in the Pacific War, very few Japanese were ever captured. For Guy to capture almost 1,500 Japanese is unthinkable.
While Gabaldon died 2 years ago at the age of 80, Rubin argues it's still not too late to recognize him with the nation's highest military honor. But regardless of what happens, the filmmaker takes satisfaction knowing this. Gabaldon's story won't just fade away, like so many old soldiers already have. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
One of the moments you'll find in the new documentary, East L.A. Marine, is Guy Gabaldon sharing lots of memories about how he captured so many enemy troops. Here's a sample.
Or D plus one, I took off on my own and went into Japanese territory, and I came back with a couple of prisoners, and my commanding officer, Colonel John Schwabe, he was a captain then, Captain John Schwabe, one hell of a nice guy. He says, don't you ever do that again. He says, this is the Marine Corps, and this is there'll be teamwork here. You're not a prima donna. You're not going to work on your own. I said, yes, sir. Very good, sir. And that night, I filled my pockets with ammunition, and I went back to Japanese territory.
You can watch video clips from the documentary East L.A. Marine and also the feature film Hell to Eternity at npr.org.